I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. If you're a fan of the Outlander novels and the television show based on the book by Diana Gabaldon, you'll want to get the new book, Outlander Kitchen, the official Outlander companion cookbook. Its author, Teresa Carl Sanders, joins me now to talk about her appreciation of Outlander and the recipes in this book. I'll ask her about the journey to where we go, the sort of cuisine we get, as well as the research involved. Teresa Carl Sanders lives on Pender Island, but joins me from here in Vancouver today. She's a professional chef and writer. Her website is at outlanderkitchen.com. The book is published by Delacorte Press, which is an imprint of Random House. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Teresa Carl Sanders. Ms. Carl Sanders, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So I told you just as we started that I've never read the Outlander books, and apparently the show on Starz, I guess we can watch that here in Canada, Showcase.
Yeah, it's on Showcase up here.
Yeah, it's doing quite well, isn't it?
It is. It's very, very popular. They're into their second season now, and they've just announced a third and fourth season, which tells you that things are going very well.
Yeah, and so for people who are like me who don't know anything about these books, the show, when does it take place?
It takes place, it starts just after World War II, and we meet Claire, who's a World War II nurse, and she is up in Scotland on a second honeymoon with her husband, and she goes for a walk and comes across a circle of standing stones, and she actually falls back in time. So she falls back to the 18th century, which is where the majority of the novels take place.
In Scotland, right?
In Scotland. The first book is in Scotland, then we move to France for the second book, and then eventually they make their way to colonial America. So there's all sorts of different continents worth of food to explore.
And I assume in the course of writing this book, a lot of research in terms of what people were eating back then.
Very much so. I went back and I have a few 18th century cookbooks on my shelves now, and I did a lot of research on the internet, and then I also decided that some older recipes just don't translate in the modern world. So there are a lot of modern updates that I've done to some of the recipes.
Yeah, I picked up a book on my shelf here at home, from a cookbook from, I guess, the 40s or the 50s, the 1940s, 1950s.
Yep.
And a lot of the portions, a lot of the things, I mean, we wouldn't think of eating that sort of stuff today.
Did
you find a lot of those things from, say, hundreds of years ago?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, even from the 40s, our diet has really changed quite radically. And if you go back any further in time, then you see that it's changed even more. There's some ingredients that we just don't have anymore, and there's some new ones that make great fill-ins.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what I learned, I think the thing I learned the most is that really historical recipes are wonderful to look at, but they're not necessarily what we can eat. To eat an 18th century diet now, most of us wouldn't be able to do it. It's just not palatable.
Yeah, and so, but in this book, Outlander Kitchen, most everything in here is palatable. Well, to me it is, because there's some things I can't eat, like cinnamon. So what's the key then for you as the author of this? Is it a lot of, say, time in the kitchen formulating these recipes to make them sort of for today?
Yeah, it's a lot of experimentation. I always started out by, if it was a historical recipe, then I started out by making a historically true recipe. And
yeah,
then my husband and I would talk about it and think about it, and then I would come up, and I would normally have to make a couple of ingredient substitutions or you know, just try and make something taste a little bit more 21st century so that we can all enjoy it. It's a fictional book,
mm-hmm,
so it should be fun. There's lots and lots of historical cookbooks that are true to life out there. This is just a little bit of a different twist on it.
Like turtle soup. No one eats that anymore, right?
No, and for example, I knew that nobody would want to go and buy a turtle.
Yeah.
So I actually use oxtail, and then I throw a little bit of Vietnamese fish sauce in there too, and that gives it a nice deep flavor like a Vietnamese pho. And you can't taste the fish, but it's there in the background, and it provides the umami that you need for that soup.
And have you had real turtle soup, though?
I have.
Yeah.
I've actually been down to New Orleans, and I have had it. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, no, I'll bet, yeah. And so this mock version that you have in the book, the mock turtle soup recipe in this book, Outlander Kitchen, the consistency, the how it feels in the mouth, say, is that the same?
It's close.
Yeah.
It's close. Turtle is often described by people as sort of a vegetable that, or an animal that tastes like all the other animals. So there's parts of the turtle that taste like pork, parts of it that taste like chicken, and I used solely beef. So, but like I say, that fish sauce that I put in there really adds a bang and gives you the mouth feel. And then there's a whole bottle of sherry in there too, and that relates back to the text that I got the idea for the food from, where the chef in that novel uses the whole bottle of sherry.
So in the books, the Outlander books, is there a lot of food, let's say, well, I guess there is, because you have lines from the text in your book, where food is described a lot. I mean, it's a big part of the story, not a big part of the story, but it's a big part of the lives of the characters in the books, right?
It is, and Diana Gabaldon, the author, uses senses and tastes and smells a lot, and so that's why she uses food a lot. She also uses food a lot because people gather around food, and so there's a lot of scenes that include food just like they do in real life.
So the flavors that people can expect, I mean, if you had to think of where the cuisine is from, is it English, is it Scottish, how would you describe it? I mean, there are a lot of Scotch pies and the sort in the book as well, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of Scottish influence in it because the story starts in Scotland and most of the characters are Scottish. But as we move across the globe and into colonial America, for example, which is where the Scots came after they were cleared from the Highlands, they were a lot of them were transported over to the east coast of the U.S., and there they had to change their diets because they came across different foods. So that's where corn starts to come into our diets, is in that colonial period, as well as pork. And both of those were non-existent in the Highlands. But the Scots took them and adapted them and used them to their own means. So there's lots of recipes that sort of go beyond that Scottish-English base.
Uh-huh.
But it's, I would say that the feet of the cookbook are definitely grounded in British cuisine.
Now, the staples that one would need, say, in their pantry, in their kitchen, because I was just looking at, I guess you have this at the beginning of the book, where you have a list of these things that one would need to make most of the things in the book, or all of the things in the book, really.
Yeah, you know, it's a time-traveling story, so you need a few different things in a time-traveling kitchen. And while there's a number of things that are out of date and we don't have anymore, there's a few things that I suggest people try just to try something new, like different types of pepper. In the 18th century, cooks in wealthy houses had access to several different types of pepper as well as salt, and they actually had a much more diverse spice cabinet than we do now.
Huh.
And long pepper comes from Indonesia, and it's actually the first spice that came out of the Spice Islands many centuries ago. And that's a nice long pepper. It's floral. It's lovely. And when you grind it in a mortar and pestle, you would be absolutely amazed at the difference between what we use as pepper now, just a little whole peppercorn. So that's one thing. I try not to use too many different extreme ingredients, just because it's hard for people sometimes to have to buy one thing for a recipe and never use it again. I really try to avoid doing that. And I live on Pender, and my grocery store is small, and the majority of the ingredients I used in the book to write the recipes are from my little grocery store.
Yeah, so it must be fun for you to be in Vancouver, where you have pretty much anything you need, right?
Where I have access to ingredients as well as restaurants. It's really nice to spend a couple of nights in Vancouver and go to a couple of different restaurants.
Say, the equipment that one would need, let's say you've just moved into a new place and you have this cookbook and you're going to cook from this cookbook for the next little while. There's nothing special that one would need to make this stuff in here, is there?
No, not at all. In fact, a chef's knife is really probably the best tool that you'll have to cook from this cookbook, and a mortar and pestle would come in handy.
Uh-huh.
If you've got a food processor, great. I'm a bit anachronistic when I use it in 18th century recipes, but it just makes everything go faster and it makes a modern kitchen run smoother. So, but you certainly don't need any of that equipment to cook any of the recipes.
Yeah, and those fancy food processors with like a million buttons, right?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm fond of a simple thing, no timers, no buttons, no control pads. The simpler it is, the longer it will last, is what I've found in my life in the kitchen.
And certainly, you're one of those people that cook that only use butter, right?
Use butter. My mother and I will go to the grave fighting over this, but butter is a whole food for me,
yeah.
And I don't touch margarine.
Yeah. What you can keep that, because I like using butter myself, and you know, for toast and for cooking too at times. But I'm always hesitant to leave it outside. But I mean, that's where it should be, right?
Yeah. You know, I leave my unsalted butter on the counter. I usually cut the package into thirds so that I've got a third out at any given time, and then the rest of it's in the fridge. Uh-huh. I don't usually put the whole pound out, but I've never had a problem. Even last summer when it was hot and hot and hot for months, I never had butter go bad. So, you know, there's some really nice butter crocks out there with cool water inserts that will keep the butter a little bit colder and a little bit fresher.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are fun. So you could use those too.
So I enjoyed the broth recipes that you have in the book. You've got a beef broth, you've got a chicken broth, and a vegetable broth. And for the longest time, I would make, say, a beef broth or a chicken broth by just taking the bones and throwing them in the pot or in the crock pot sometimes, if I don't want to have to stand over the stove. And but I guess the real way to make broth is you roast the bones first. Is that right?
That's for a brown stock, and that's where you get all the flavor. In a deep, rich, dark brown soup, it's generally started, if it's made by a chef, with a brown stock. And brown stock means you roast the bones, and you also add a little bit of tomato paste for color.
Mm. Yeah, and the recipe, there's one recipe in the book about how the broth can be taken. Is it cold, or is it, I mean?
That's a beef tea. So that's a really old, old recipe, one they used to use as a restorative, almost as medicine. And you can serve it hot, but you can, because it's got so much gelatin in it, you can, when you put it in the fridge, you can actually serve it cold, and it's really more like a jelly.
And so when would you serve that if you had people over?
I would serve like a beef tea or a similar thing as a consommé to start a meal, and a consommé can be served chilled as well, and it's really lovely in the summer. It's got a really deep, meaty flavor, whether you use chicken or beef, whichever. It's very, very deep. It's very clear, and it's a really nice way to whet your appetite. You don't need very much. It's generally served in a demi-tasse, you know, half a cup, and it just sort of sparks the appetite.
And the other thing that I got out of your book was when you chill the broths, you have to cool them before you put them in the fridge. And that's for safety, is it? Or
that's a 21st century food safe concern. You don't really want to let broth cool on the counter because it will take hours, and at that point, broth can be quite dangerous in terms of. So if you fill the sink, for example, with ice and cold water, and then put the container of stock into the sink in that water, it will cool down much faster. You could put it in the fridge to cool down, but the problem with that is that when you put something hot in the fridge, then you've got condensation going on, and you're affecting the temperatures of the other things in the fridge.
Oh, I see, yeah. Diana Gabaldon writes the foreword to this book. How much do you know her?
I've met her a few times. I had to ask her permission to start the whole project to begin with 5 years ago, and she was very, very, very supportive. She's a busy lady. She travels all over the world, and she's been selling these books sort of one at a time for a long time, and so she's very approachable. And I've had a couple of nice interactions with her in the evenings after signings, and I'm really looking forward to, on the 24th, I'm flying down to Scottsdale, Arizona, where she lives, and we're doing a big book signing and launch for Outlander Kitchen there. She's been very supportive.
She's seen the recipes to the book, and it's true to the spirit of that which she's written, right?
Yes. She's very happy, I think, with how this has all come together. It's a fictional book, and the cookbook is meant to be a bit of fun. So there's lots of character-inspired recipes. There's lots of modern adaptions as well as the historical stuff. And Diana's a smart, funny, witty lady, and I think she likes the way I've played with the food.
You dedicate the book to Howard. Who's he?
He's my husband.
What kind of, go ahead. Pardon me, I interrupted you.
I was just going to say he's my husband, and he's been really another one that supported me all the way through this, and I couldn't have done it without him. And he thought this was, he used to be an old J.R.R. Tolkien fan. So he knows about fandoms, and he knows the power of them, and he thought it was a really great idea. So he's been behind me, watching me do this for many years.
What kind of food does he like from the book?
He likes most of it, actually. He's actually English. I met him over there. Mm-hmm. We've been married for 22 years, and so he appreciates the old home-style cooking, and he's not really a sweet freak, so he's more of a main course kind of guy, and there's quite a few of them that he really likes. Ragout pork is one of his favorites, actually.
Yeah. No, that's a good one, I thought. Yeah, the one that really interested me was the fried chicken, and so would you tell us what you do with the fried chicken?
Sure, that's an example of where I kind of threw 100 years of fried chicken knowledge out the window, and I did my own thing, and I brine the chicken in a sweet tea. Sweet tea is a very southern drink. It's sweet beyond belief to our northern palates.
It's not like iced tea, right?
It's iced tea, but it's iced tea with 4 times more sugar than you think should be in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I add salt to that as well to brine the chicken. And that adds, it gives it a really nice flavor, gives it a little bit of tenderness. And then it's, after it's been brined, it's basically just coated in a bunch of different spices and then fried up. It's really nice. I use boneless chicken in that recipe just because it's easier and I find it makes a little bit less mess. Fried chicken can be a really messy dinner to make.
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, because you can get fried chicken. Well, not you can't get it as you know, it's not as ubiquitous as say hamburgers. But it seems like it'd be messy to make in the kitchen. That's why I've never tried it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not something you're going to make maybe on a Monday night, but on a Saturday or a Sunday, it's a fun thing to make, and it's a fun way to connect with the characters of your favorite book. If you've been a reader of Outlander.
Yeah. And the back to equipment for just a sec, you're a fan of the cast iron.
I am a cast iron girl, absolutely. There's no nonstick in my house.
Yeah.
I find it quite dangerous. And I've been really lucky, and I've managed to pick up all my cast iron pans at recycling centers.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, rusty old pans that people sort of discard, and they just need a little bit of TLC to get them back.
So you can bring it back even if it's, say, rusty at the bottom?
You can bring cast iron back from almost solid rust. What I did is I actually put it in our, when we went to bed in the winter, we have a wood stove running every night on Pender, and when we went to bed, I would stick one of those pans in, and in the morning, I'd pull it out, and all the rust was gone. It was all burned off, and it just needed to be oiled up and sealed again.
So that's the key to keeping it nonstick, is to do that regularly, right, to oil it and I guess season, is that what they call it?
It's to season it, exactly, and never wash it with soap. If you have to use soap, you use one drop, and I use one of those little plastic scrubbies.
Uh-huh.
I usually just wash it with hot water, though, and then before I put it away, I take a paper towel with a couple of drops of oil and just wipe the inside.
What sort of oil? Just olive oil, or?
I wouldn't use olive oil, but maybe vegetable oil. Mm. Avocado oil is great. Coconut oil also works.
Where does one get avocado oil, by the way?
Oh, is that specialty shop.
Okay, because it's not something like
any,
yeah.
Any Whole Foods or specialty shop. I order it online.
Yeah. The cover of the book has these strawberry tarts, and you know, I like sweets like anybody else, but I never make them because, like fried chicken, I think it's messy, I think it's time-consuming, but this recipe isn't.
No, the strawberry tart recipe is very, very, it's an old English sweet. My husband actually grew up eating them, jam tarts. And I give you a recipe for pastry, but if you don't have time, you could always just buy frozen tart shells.
Mm-hmm.
And par bake them, and then you literally spoon a little bit of jam into each one, put them back into the oven for a few minutes, and you're done.
And then you top them with fresh strawberries.
And the photographer for the cover had a great idea and covered them with strawberries, and it makes it that much more beautiful.
Yeah,
they're a really pretty little thing.
Yeah, and they look like you spent a lot of time to make them.
They do, and that's one of those are sort of my favorite types of recipes where it looks a lot more complicated than it is.
And there's recipes in this book that fit the seasons. I mean, we're speaking in mid-June where it's supposed to be really hot, and it's not quite hot in Vancouver today.
No.
We're quite wet and rainy, but I mean, there are recipes for all the seasons, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very... when you go back in time with food, you, of course, have to go to the local, sustainable kind of movement, and that's exactly what happens, is... You could cook seasonally without Kentlander Kitchen quite easily, and I have. for many years.
So you're in Vancouver, and you lived here for a while, and you come back to visit, as you said earlier. Are there certain places that you like going to while in town?
Yeah, I do. I've got a few old favorites. For sushi, I love Shiro's, which is on 16th, which is on Cambie, sort of just below 16th.
Right.
And I went to a new place I went to last night for dinner, was actually Tableau, which is in my hotel at the bottom. It's the Loden Hotel on Melville. And Tableau is a lovely little brasserie bistro type of place. And I had a prawn and pork belly main last night that I will remember for a very, very long time. It was very, very nice.
So you mentioned earlier on living on Pender Island, how hard it is to get certain things. Mm-hmm. In terms of what's, say, local, in terms of, say, the meat and the sort, I mean, you can get pretty much all of that, can't you?
Oh, yeah. We can buy it in the grocery store. We've got a fair-sized butcher.
Yeah.
But we also grow lamb and cattle on Pender. So if you know a farmer, you can also get, you also have access to that, as well as eggs, of course, and chicken.
Yeah. Well, this is such a beautifully photographed book as well. Who's the photographer?
Thank you. The photographer is Rebecca Wellman. She's from Victoria.
Uh-huh.
And she actually, I love to give her props because she and I decided it would be easier if we worked separately. So she actually did most of the cooking as well as all the food styling for most of her shots. There's only a couple of dishes. I made turtle soup and I froze it and took it over on the ferry to Victoria, and then she thawed it out and photographed it, as well as there's a tortellini recipe, and I made the tortellini and she made the sauce. But she's an amazingly talented woman, and I was really, really lucky to get her to photograph this book.
And so when she made the stuff for herself to photograph, and you weren't around, did she give you any feedback as to say how the recipes were crafted? Because reading the book, it seems like, I mean, I'm not savvy in the kitchen, but I think I can make this stuff, you know?
Oh, I think you can make this stuff. You know, I've had the blog for 5 years. I had a lot of people making stuff all the way along, and I've had good feedback about my recipes, that they're clearly written. I have an order. I'm a creative person, but I have an orderly mind, and I think that's a good combination when you're writing recipes. Rebecca gave me some great feedback.
Yeah.
She was my first tester. I had another 10 testers do all the recipes subsequently later on in the process, but Rebecca gave me lots of great feedback.
When we started the interview, I asked you about Outlander and just how much a fan you are of it. Is it something that you'd recommend for people? I mean, I watch Mad Men and Downton Abbey and you know, all the sitcoms. Is it something that you think I'd get into?
You know, I was talking to Steve Darling. I was on Global TV
this
morning, and I was talking to Steve Darling, and he doesn't strike me as an Outlander fan. He's a really passionate Outlander fan. I think a lot of people think it has too much romance in it for the male audience, but the male audience is growing on the TV series because we're entering a Scottish period of civil war in the series now.
Mm.
So there's lots of action. It's a bit risque. There's quite a lot of sex in the first season, but it's a really good story. And if you like an escapist kind of fantastical story, then you'll probably like Outlander.
Yeah, I was reading something, I don't know if it was in Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, about the sex scenes in Outlander, and just how enlightened they are.
Yeah, I think it was Variety. I think I've read that article, and what they say is basically that it's a new way of looking at a sex scene. You know, for the last decades on television,
yeah,
a lot of scenes are filmed from a male perspective, and Outlander is the story of Claire and her adventures, and so we see a more female perspective of sex where pleasure, for example, and love are more important than action.
Yeah.
And I find it quite refreshing. I know a lot of my friends do as well.
Yeah. Well, it's such a pleasure talking to you today because you've opened me up to a show that I hadn't thought of watching, and certainly after reading this book, we'll look into it. And this book, I mean, it's something that I'll be cooking from for the next little while for sure.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that. That makes me really happy.
Congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Thank you so much, Joe.
the website, outlanderkitchen.com. The book is called Outlander Kitchen, the official Outlander companion cookbook. It's published by Delacorte, which is an imprint of Random House. Its author, Teresa Carl Sanders, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.